on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: ليس شيء أنكى لإبليس وجنوده من زيارة الإخوان في الله بعضهم لبعض.
Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam stated, "Nothing is more hurtful to Iblis Satan and his army than brothers in faith visiting each other for the sake of Allah."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues and conversations of the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Now, this divinely appointed Imam, in his conversations, His Eminence spoke about certain general directions which he responded to when one of his companions asked him about these certain guidelines for human life. In one such instance, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he said to his companion in reply to this question, he replied, "The morals of one with whom you associate with are knowledge." Now, it's interesting here, we really learn so much from the morals and the manners of each other. So, for example, when we have a person who we associate with, and perhaps they joke too much, and we feel uncomfortable with this idea that the said individual jokes too much, well, then we should try that in our personality and for our case, we should not joke too much. Or if we by chance, God forbid, know somebody who enjoys backbiting, well, first and foremost, we should not associate with people who backbite, for as the divinely appointed imams of the Ahlul Bayt say, that when you associate with one who backbites, eventually you will become the target of the backbiting itself. But let's say for some unfortunate reason we are associated with somebody who tends to backbite. Well, then if we don't like that trait in another individual, we should also do our best that we should not backbite. And so it's very important to kind of take into consideration the morals, whether negative in this case, but positive as well in other people that we associate with. If you find that another individual is very truthful, they're very honest, they're very kind, they're very merciful, they're very, generous, then this knowledge should be inculcated within us, and we should also apply those positive morals in our lives as well. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imama of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. The point we're trying to make here is that this transition, or this event that took place rather, to get to that transition, the Ahlul Bayt, in a sense, had to shift gears. There had to be a transition. There had to be a shifting of gears in the movement that the Ahlul Bayt had established. And this is important for us to understand. It's relevant to us, hopefully, if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala guides our minds and thoughts and words, will be able to discuss the relevance of this topic to us today and why it is that we believe we need to understand this and discuss it, not just for matters of historic relevance and understanding the history of the imams, which that is important, but the importance of it is mainly due to this, to understand the teachings they have given us through their behavior, through their decisions, through the strategies they had, the tactics they had, the words they gave, the direction they gave. Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, is dealing with masses that were involved in overthrowing the Umayyads, and they were involved in establishing the government of the Abbasids, thinking that the Abbasids are the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet and the ones that Islam has given authority to. And so they were initially happy, first for not having the Umayyads rule over them, and secondly for having the Ahlul Bayt rule over them. People were initially happy because of both of those.
Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight. For the last 2 decades, the United States has been conducting an undeclared war across much of the globe, employing proxy forces from Africa to Asia, deploying commandos from the Philippines to the West African nation of Burkina Faso, and conducting airstrikes not only in Libya but in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Over those years, the U.S. military has taken pains to normalize the use of drone warfare outside established war zones while relying on allies around the world to help conduct its global war. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Nick Turris, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Global Drone War Has Killed Untold Numbers of Civilians, Including Children. Madhubaz Musa Abdullah still remembers the phone call, but what came next was a blur. He drove for hours deep into the Libyan desert, speeding toward the border with Algeria. His mind buckled, his thoughts reeled, and more than 3 years later, he is still not certain how he made that six-hour journey. The call was about his younger brother, Nasser, who, as he told reporters, was more than a sibling to him. He was also a close friend. Nasser was polite and caring. He loved music, sang, and played the guitar. Abdullah finally found Nasser near the village of Al-Ayanat. Or rather, he found all that remained of him. Nasser and 10 others from their village of Obari had been riding in 3 SUVs that were now burnt-out hunks of metal. The 11 men had been incinerated. Abdullah knew one of those charred corpses was his brother, but he was at a loss to identify which one. If these bodies had recently been found strewn about in the village of Bucha or other places outside a train station in Kramatorsk or elsewhere, the images would have been splashed across the internet, earning worldwide attention and prompting fierce and justified outrage. Instead, the day after the attack, November 29, 2018, U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, issued a press release that was met with almost universal silence. Earlier this month, Abdullah, along with a spokesperson for his ethnic Tuareg community and representatives of 3 non-governmental organizations, the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, Italy's Rete Italiana, PACE, DO, Disarmo, and Reprieve, a human rights advocacy group, filed a criminal complaint against Colonel Cirati, the former Italian commander at the U.S. Air Base in Sinola, Italy, from which that American drone took off. They were seeking accountability for his role in the killing of Nasser and those other 10 men. The complaint requested that the public prosecutor's office in Siracusa, where the base is located, prosecute Colonel Cirati and other Italian officials involved in that airstrike for the crime of murder. The drone attack of November 29, 2018, where 11 innocent people lost their lives in Libya, is part of the broader U.S. program of extrajudicial killings. This program is based on a notion of preemptive self-defense that does not meet the canons of international law, as the use of lethal attacks of this nature is only legitimate where the state is acting to defend itself against an imminent threat to life. In this circumstance, the victims pose no threats, reads the criminal complaint. In light of this premise, the drone attack on Al-Ayanat on November 29, 2018, stands in frontal contrast to the discipline, Italian and international, regarding the use of lethal force in the context of law enforcement operations. For the last 2 decades, the United States has been conducting an undeclared war across much of the globe, employing proxy forces from Africa to Asia, deploying commandos from the Philippines to the West African nation of Burkina Faso, and conducting airstrikes not only in Libya but in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Over those years, the U.S. military has taken pains to normalize the use of drone warfare outside established war zones while relying on allies around the world, as that Italian base in Syracuse, to help conduct its global war. Clearly, a drone operation employing lethal force is not routine, said Meloni, legal advisor at European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, adding, while AFRICOM is directly responsible, the Italian commander must have known about and approved the operation and can therefore be criminally responsible as an accomplice for having allowed the unlawful lethal attack. That November 2018, drone attack in Libya was anything but a one-off strike. During just 6 months in 2011, alone, U.S. MQ-1 Predator drones flying from Signola conducted 241 airstrikes in Libya during Operation Unified Protector, the NATO air campaign against then-Libyan autocrat Muammar Gaddafi, according to retired Lieutenant Colonel Gary Peppers, the former commander of the 324th Expeditionary Reconnaissance Squadron. The unit was responsible, he told The Intercept in 2018, for over 20% of the total of all Hellfire missiles expended in 14 years of the system's deployment. The U.S. air war in Libya accelerated in 2016 with Operation Odyssey Lightning. That summer, the Libyan government of National Accord requested American help in dislodging Daesh from Sirte. The Obama administration designated the city an area of active hostilities, loosening guidelines designed to prevent civilian casualties. Between August and December of that year, according to an African press release, the U.S. carried out in Sirte alone 495 precision airstrikes against vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, heavy guns, tanks, command and control centers, and fighting positions. Those military strikes were nothing new. The United States has been conducting attacks in Libya since before there even was a Libya, and almost a United States. In his first address to Congress in 1801, President Thomas Jefferson spoke of coastal kingdoms in North Africa, including the least considerable of Barbary states, Tripoli, now the capital of modern Libya. His refusal to pay additional tribute to the rulers of those kingdoms in order to stop their state-sponsored privateers from seizing American sailors and cargo kicked off the Barbary Wars. In 1804, Lieutenant Stephen Decatur led a daring nighttime mission, boarding a captured U.S. ship, killing its Tripolitan defenders and destroying it. And an attack the next year by 9 Marines and a host of Allied mercenaries on the North African city of Derna ensured that the shores of Tripoli would have prime placement in the Marine Corps high. A June 2021 Pentagon report on civilian casualties did acknowledge one of those incidents, the death of a civilian in Al-Baida, Yemen, on January 22, 2019. Matbana's investigation determined that the attack killed Saleh Ahmed Mohammed Al-Ghaisi, a 67-year-old farmer who locals said had no terrorist affiliations. The U.S. had previously acknowledged 4 to 12 civilian deaths in a raid by Navy SEALs on January 29, 2017, also chronicled by Matwana. Through it reported a high death toll. As for the remaining allegations, Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in the West Asia region, told Matwana in an April 2021 letter that it was confident that each airstrike hit its intended Al-Qaeda targets and nothing else. Rigorous investigative reporting by the New York Times on the last U.S. drone strike of the Afghan war in August 2021 forced an admission from the Pentagon. What General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had originally deemed a righteous strike had actually killed 10 civilians, 7 of them children. A subsequent Times investigation revealed that the 2019 U.S. airstrike in Baghouz, Syria, had killed up to 64 non-combatants, a toll previously obscured through a multi-layered cover-up. The Times followed that up with an investigation of 1,300 reports of civilian casualties in Iraq and Syria, demonstrating, wrote reporter Azmat Khan, that the American air war in those countries was marked by deeply flawed intelligence, rushed and often imprecise targeting, and the deaths of thousands of civilians, many of them children, a sharp contrast to the American government's image of war waged by all-seeing drones and precision bombs. Since the search campaign ended in late 2016, U.S. attacks in Libya have slowed considerably. AFRICOM conducted 7 declared airstrikes there in 2017, 6 in 2018, 4 in 2019, and none since. But the U.S. military has made little effort to re-evaluate past strikes and the civilian casualties they caused, including the November 2018 attack that killed Nasser Musa Abdullah. U.S. Africa Command followed the civilian casualty assessment process in place at the time and determined that the reports were unsubstantiated, said AFRICOM spokesperson Kelly Callan. Despite the criminal complaint filed on April 1st, the command is not re-examining the case. There is nothing new or different regarding the November 30, 2018 airstrike, Callan told reporters by email. Africa Command has clearly moved on, but Abdullah Kent's memories of his brother and those charred bodies are irrevocably lodged in his mind, but get caught in his throat. He says, "I was in shock." He told reporters when discussing the phone call that preceded his dash across the desert. "I'm so sorry, but I can't explain in words what I felt." Abdullah was similarly stuck when he attempted to describe the grisly scene that greeted him hours later. He was eloquent in speaking about the justice he seeks and how being branded a terrorist robbed his brother and their community of dignity. But of his final memory of Nasser, there is simply nothing that can be said. Not by him anyway. What I was seeing was so terrible, he told reporters, his voice rising, racked and loaded with pain, adding, "I can't even describe it."
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection
of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
خصلت یک مؤمنه وقتی روح ایمان درش قویه نمیتونه آروم بشینه.
One of the major characteristics of a strong believer is the sense of accountability about the problems of others. In difficult situations, the faithful believers cannot sit still without doing anything. The late Agha Sayyid Mahdi Qawam was among great Muslim scholars who always felt responsible about the problems of his brothers in faith. He was concerned not only about the problems of his fellow men and women, but also the rights of the animals.
یه مرتبه آقای آسد مهدی قوام رسید. تا دید او رو لباساشو در آورد، عمامه‌شو گذاشت کنار رو لباساش.
It is narrated that once Sayyid Mahdi saw a dog whose hand was stuck under a stone in a river. When seeing such a scene, the Sayyid took off his clothes and went to the river to save the dog. He took the dog out of the river and put him on the dry land. The dog shot himself dry and left. This is how the great believers are concerned about their surroundings, including the difficulties of the lives of the people and even the animals. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Kalav Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is the teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and the most outstanding works of Muslim scholars, jurists, philosophers all across the world of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program, and with me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic Hausa of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyania. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyania, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So today we want to talk about an outstanding Muslim Shia figure, a religious authority and faqih, who had also mastery over Arabic literature, philosophy, tafsir, mysticism. He is no one but Muhammad Hussein Kashaf al-Ghita, the author of the magnum opus, Asl al-Shia wa Usuluha. This is, we can say, one of the most outstanding works, or it's better to say the best work of Muhammad Hussein Kashaf al-Ghita. We will dedicate, inshallah, some parts of our program to this book. Before that, we want to be more familiar with this outstanding man and the early life. Sheikh Mahtavi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life of Muhammad Hussein Kashaf al-Ghita.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashaf al-Ghita is born in 1294, according to lunar calendar, in Najaf. He is from a very well-known and popular family entitled Kashaf al-Ghita. Maybe our listeners are familiar with the name Sheikh Ja'far Kashaf al-Ghita more than Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashaf al-Ghita. This is very important for them to know that Sheikh Ja'far Kashaf al-Ghita is regarded as his grandfather, who was the teacher of Sheikh Muhammad Hassan Najafi, the author of Jawahir al-Kalam, that I am sure that we dedicated one episode regarding the outstanding scholar, the author of Jawahir al-Kalam. So Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashaf al-Ghita is the descendant of this family. He is born in Najaf. And he has benefited from the great ulama, namely we can talk about the Akhund Khorasani and also Sayyid Muhammad Kazem Yazdi, the author of Urwatul Wuthqa.
Yes.
And I'm sure that we talked about all of these authors in the program, The Teacher, Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah.
Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashaf al-Ghita is known for his... Actually, one of the aspects that we may talk a bit, a little about it, is about his trips to different Islamic territories, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. Actually, he was in Iraq.
Yes.
And having a lot of meeting with other scholars from other sects.
From
the Sunnis.
Islamic
sects.
That's right.
So he was one of those scholars who was really interested in bringing about all authors from different sects, Islamic sects, around one table and talking about the unity. His Salat in the Palestine, he was invited to the conference of Palestine. In that conference, many scholars had been invited, and they asked him to lead the Salat. And it was a very important occasion, an incident that was narrated by the recent authors as the symbol of the unity.
Unity, al-wahda.
Yes, symbol of the unity.
That's right. Yeah. Very good. So, and I think these thoughts and these methods and approach of Muhammad Hossein Kashaf al-Ghita made him one of the most outstanding figures in comparative fiqh, Sheikh Ziyaniya, fiqh al-Tatbiqi, isn't it?
Yeah.
What is fiqh al-Tatbiqi that Muhammad Hossein Kashaf al-Ghita was specialized in?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Comparative fiqh is a field of study in which the scholars try to compare the different fatwa and ideas of different scholars amongst Shia and Sunnis. And when we trace back this field of study, we find late Allama Shaykh al-Ta'ifa, Shaykh al-Tusi, rahmatullah alayh, as one of the great figures who compiled a book regarding comparative fiqh, and that was Kitab al-Khilaf. And we know that Shaykh al-Tusi was living in 5th century.
Yes.
So it's about 8 centuries before Marhum Kashif al-Ghita.
Yes.
But
he imitated the method of Shaykh al-Tusi.
Yeah, so no, it's not the matter of imitation. It's the field of study that, of course, before Shaykh al-Ta'ifa, also some of other scholars entered into this field and had some works, but the first book that was a complete one was covering different subjects of fiqh according to Shia fatwa and Sunni school of fatwa was Al-Khilaf from Shaykh al-Tusi.
That's right.
And Kashaf al-Ghita, rahmatullah alayhi, also got benefit from the
method
of Al-Khilaf and this field of study.
That's right.
So maybe some person would say that, okay, what is the benefit of comparative fiqh?
This is the question, yes.
When we study comparative fiqh, first of all, we come to this point that there are many similarities between Shia and Sunni school of thought, even in Ahkam.
Okay.
And this gives us this, point of view that, okay, yeah, there are some differences, but according to the verses of the Holy Quran, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم قل يا أهل الكتاب تعالوا إلى كلمة سواء بيننا وبينكم ألا نعبد إلا الله ولا نشرك به شيئا, to the end of the ayah. We Muslims ourselves should also sit around the same table to discuss about the similarities that we have, because Quran says you Muslims sit and discuss with non-Muslims about the similarities that you have with them. So obviously Muslims themselves, they should sit around the same table.
Yes.
That's why comparative fiqh gives us this, point of view to find the similarities.
That's why.
Besides that, when we find the differences, we find the argumentations, the reasons that different schools of thought have brought up for their ideas. For example, Shia school of thought believes in a different type of making wudu.
Yes.
Sunni school of thought is believing in different type of wudu.
Okay, you mean the style of taking ablution of wudu is different. That's right, okay.
So what is their reasons? What is their argumentation?
The background.
What is the sources that they have come to this point to make different type
that's
of wudu?
Right. Okay.
So in comparative fiqh, we compare the reasons.
That's right.
And we compare the ideas of ulama.
And he was welcomed because of his achievements in comparative fiqh, because they say that Muhammad Hussein al-Kashaf al-Ghita was respectful
towards the ideas and the opinions of the other sects, for example, about fiqh al-Hanafi, you know, fiqh al-Shafi and fiqh al-Shia, Isna al-Shari. He made the comparisons, writes the books or articles in different points of view. But, you know, at the same time, he was a man of unity, as Sheikh Mahtawi said.
Yeah.
I mean, his works on the differences and comparative study did not make him as a person who is opposing other denominations, but a person who tries to achieve unity and solidarity among the Muslims. This is what is really needed among the Muslim scholars even nowadays.
Yeah.
One of the main concerns of the late Muhammad Hussein al-Kashf al-Ghita was defending the legacy of Shia beliefs and the Shia history. That's why he compiled the book Asl al-Shia wa Usulaha. Sheikh Mahtawi, what is this book?
Okay, this book, Asl al-Shia wa Usulaha, before we talk about this book, we have to talk about the environment in which he was living.
Mm-hmm.
He himself is saying that in the place that I was living, a group of Shia youth went to Egypt in order to complete his study in the universities in Egypt. But they came back to me saying that there are a lot of rumors and accusations against Shia,
okay,
some of which was written by Ahmad al-Amin. There is one statement from Ahmad al-Amin. He says that Shia is a shelter for anyone who wants to demolish Islam. He himself, I mean, Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashif al-Ghita, after hearing this statement from Ahmad al-Amin, he says, this is not the moment of staying silence.
Mm-hmm.
This is not only to take revenge, to talk something in order to respond what Ahmad al-Amin has said. Now this is the moment we have to unveil the truth for the people. Because through this poisonous environment, because of being fed by such poisonous articles and information, people will not get this chance to have a true judgment about the realities, what has happened. That's why he decides to author this book. As you said,
in an answer to Fajr al-Islam,
the book Fajr al-Islam.
Ahmad al-Amin.
This is very interesting.
Right. Yes.
We have to look at the approach of Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashif al-Ghita. He has taken a very technical and respectful approach that Ahmad al-Amin, after all, he get this chance to have a meeting with Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashif al-Ghita, and he himself described that meeting as Hayati. He dedicated one topic under the title of Hayati, meaning that my life, as if I got revived through the meeting with Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashif al-Ghita. Who is Ahmad al-Amin? Ahmad al-Amin is someone who is accusing Shia and Shia sect as a shelter for those who are going to demolish Islam. But this is the approach of Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashif al-Ghita in response to these actually poisonous information, letters and data which are being shed and poured upon the minds of Shia or Muslim youth.
Also the lack of information about the Shia beliefs and the Shia history, I think, is another, we can say, goal of Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashif al-Ghita. Because so many Muslims, even nowadays, you know, when I have interaction with some of the Muslims and I ask them, for example, about the Shia imams or their books, for example, or the books that have been compiled about them, for example, do you know Natul Balagha? They might say no. Or do you know Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya, Rasalat al-Huquq by Imam al-Sajjad? Or do you know this, do you know that of Imam al-Baghir, Imam al-Sadiq? They really do not have much information about that. And the scholars like Kashif al-Ghita feel committed in order to answer such doubts and questions.
And generally speaking, we might divide this book into two divisions or two parts. In the first part, he tries to talk about the establishment of Shiism and the roots of Shia, the way it spread all around the world. And the second part, it talks about the creeds, fundamentals and usul, and everything which is related to the Shia, I mean from the Ahkam and Kalam and Usul. So that is a very important book for those who are seeking the truth. This is not the only work of Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashif al-Ghita. This is very interesting for me, myself. It was really astonishing when I came up with this information that because of the huge works of Sheikh Muhammad Hussain Kashif al-Ghita, recently this institution is trying to collect his works into different volumes called Al-Mawsu'a, Mawsu'atu Sheikh Kashif al-Ghita. And in this Mawsu'a, it is not only about one topic. It has been divided in three topics. Kalam, which contains 14 volumes only in terms of Kalam.
That's right.
20 volumes in terms of fiqh and jurisprudence.
That's right.
And 16 volumes regarding the politics, history, and literature.
Yes.
So if you put all of these together, it reaches a number of 50 volumes talking about Islam and Islamic information. It unveils the level of his knowledge regarding the Islam.
Even they claim that Muhammad Hussain al-Kashaf al-Ghita, the late, you know, is one of the revivers of Islamic kalam or theology. And different rulings. I mean, his approach, even into Islamic laws or al-ahkam, was different. You know, on the new cases that will happen in an environment regarding, for example, the women or different new
music,
cases.
Even about the music
and different cases. You know, he said he had this novel approach and novel ideas, and making comparison between denomination was really outstanding part of his approach, which made him really prominent. Okay, Sheikh Ziyaniya, anything missed about Astushia wa Usulaha? This book also has been translated into Farsi language by Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi, as in Farsi the title is Inast Ayin Ma. Okay.
As you said, the book is translated by Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi, Hafadahullah, and we should mention that Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi is a student of Marhum Sheikh Muhammad Hussain Kashif al-Ghita. And I should mention this point, that when Al-Muraja'at al-Rihaniya was written by Marhum Kashif al-Ghita.
This is another book.
Yes, Al-Muraja'at al-Rihaniya is a book that was in response to the notes of Ahmad al-Amin and also Georgi Zeidan, especially Georgi Zeidan's misunderstandings. But then, because there were not, this book, Al-Muraja'at al-Rihaniya, was not a complete book. It moved on, and after some other books that it was going to be completed, we come to Aslu Shia wa Usulaha. That at the beginning of this book, in the introduction of this book, late Kashif al-Ghita says that I do not want to highlight the points that want to raise or wage a war between Shia and Sunni school of thought, but I want to talk about Shia school of thought's beliefs clearly.
Yes.
To show our position clearly to our brothers, to know that what is our relationship to each other and how we can deal with each other. Because if I do not know my brother, then maybe my behavior would make him angry, while I did not know that my behavior is not, you know, is insulting.
Or my judgment will be wrong if I do not know
so
him.
So that's why he tries to give the Shia point of view clearly, to make our position clear to the brothers of Ahlus Sunnah. And the final point about this book, Aslu Shia wa Usulaha, is that we should say that there are three important, you know, characteristics or attributes of this book. First of all, the text of the book is not, you know, long and tiring.
Complicated.
But it's not long. So it gives the concepts briefly and do not try to give, you know, words and, you know, to give different sentences.
Okay.
Another important point is that the clearness or the clarity. The clarity of the sentences is really important. And the last but not least is that the author of the book is trying to rely on authentic issues, not to just, you know, raise some, you know, rumors. No, he just gives the authentic subjects that gives the audience authentic content.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya, for your elaboration on the life account of Muhammad Hussain Kashif al-Ghita, the author of the magnum opus Aslu Shia wa Usulaha, in defense of the Shia history and the Shia legacy. This outstanding man passed away on Zilqa'da 18th, 1373, according to the Hijra calendar, in Kermanshah in Iran. His body was taken into Najaf al-Ashraf and then into the Wadi al-Salam cemetery, the greatest and the biggest cemetery of the Shia world, in Najaf al-Ashraf, and he was buried over there. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, Muhammad Hussein al-Kashif al-Ghita. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman Allah.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
North Korea has fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast. South Korea says the missiles were fired from an area of the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. In recent weeks, North Korea has test-fired a range of ballistic missiles, including its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. The latest one comes just a day after South Korea and the United States wrapped up their first combined military drills involving an American aircraft carrier in more than 4 years. Pyongyang has frequently protested against Seoul and Washington's joint military exercises, calling them rehearsals for invasion, despite Washington's talk of diplomacy. The latest test marks the 18th time that North Korea has fired its missiles this year, including what the U.S. says was a failed intercontinental ballistic missile test on May 4th that exploded shortly after launch. Last month, North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, said he would strengthen and develop his country's nuclear forces at the highest possible speed. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has failed to restart diplomatic talks with Pyongyang as tensions escalate. Former U.S. President Donald Trump attempted to court Pyongyang, but even though he met with the North Korean leader 3 times, he refused to relieve any of the sanctions in return for the several steps taken by Pyongyang toward denuclearization. That hampered further diplomacy between Pyongyang and Washington and prompted Kim to announce an end to a moratorium on the country's missile tests.
So it understands that a country that does not have a formidable arsenal can be subject to US attack because it's considered weak. So this is part of it. Well, if it wants to remain the hermit kingdom, it must look to be strong and unpredictable, and this is how it uses its military, the projection of its military force.
North Korea, which has been under rounds of crushing UN sanctions since 2006 over its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, has ramped up its missile launches this year. The sanctions have led to rising levels of poverty and food insecurity. Despite the acknowledged food insecurity in North Korea, however, the United Nations Humanitarian Response Plan does not include an appeal for assistance to North Korea. A UN World Food Program report in 2019 concluded that 11 million of North Korea's 25 million people were undernourished, and one of every 5 children were stunted from lack of adequate nutrition. Last month, China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push at the United Nations to toughen sanctions on North Korea over its renewed ballistic missile launches. China, the North's closest ally, and Russia, whose relations with the West have sharply deteriorated over its military operation in Ukraine, said they would have preferred a non-binding statement instead of a fresh resolution against Pyongyang. Beijing warned that sanctions would cause an escalation and humanitarian consequences for North Korea, which has been recently hit by COVID outbreak. Meanwhile, Russia said Washington is ignoring Pyongyang's appeals to stop hostile activity. During the past 16 years, the UN Security Council has steadily and unanimously ramped up sanctions to cut off funding for North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. Since 2017, when the Council last stepped up sanctions on Pyongyang, China and Russia have been trying to ease sanctions on humanitarian grounds.
Because it's a coercive power. It doesn't want to treat another country on equal or humane terms, because, I mean, it doesn't want to preserve the current leadership of North Korea. It wants regime change.
In particular, China's strategic overture to North Korea since the collapse of U.S.-North Korea diplomatic talks in 2019 has drawn the two countries closer. With tensions rising over the U.S.-China competition and a new South Korean conservative government that vows to take a harder line on North Korea and China, Beijing has more incentive to keep Pyongyang close.
Tehran has blasted the controversial visit by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency to Israel. The IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, held talks with the Israeli regime's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, in Tel Aviv, days after criticism of Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Iran's foreign ministry has warned of further erosion of the agency's credibility, while its director general kept silent on Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said this questions the IAEA's impartiality. Grossi's visit to Tel Aviv came in the backdrop of a report by the IAEA alleging that Iran has not clarified the presence of nuclear material at three sites. Khatibzadeh, pointing to the UN nuclear body's blatant double standards, said the world powers cannot overlook Israel's weapons program while indulging in rhetoric about Iran's peaceful atomic program. Israel has never signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty that aims to ensure civilian use of nuclear technology. Tel Aviv possesses the largest number of nuclear warheads in the region and has never allowed IAEA inspectors to scrutinize its nuclear sites. On the other hand, Iran, despite being a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, continues to reel under harsh sanctions for pursuing a peaceful nuclear program. Earlier this week, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett accused Iran of stealing classified documents from the IAEA and using them to deceive international inspectors nearly two decades ago. Iran rejected the allegations as outright lies. The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors is scheduled to hold a meeting on Monday, with all eyes on the agency's latest report. The meeting is reportedly set to adopt an anti-Iran resolution drafted by Britain, France, Germany, and the United States to accuse the Islamic Republic of withholding cooperation with the agency. Israel backs the draft resolution to rebuke Iran by the IAEA Board of Governors. Tehran has warned against any unconstructive action at the upcoming meeting of the body, saying it will respond immediately and proportionately.
The right to resist this kind of bullying and coercion and sort of domination from the West, that right to resist is not allowed. You were never allowed to resist. And anything Iran does to preserve its independence is going to be labeled as dangerous and subversive somehow to the international order, and on and on and on.
Iran says the visit by the International Atomic Energy Agency's chief, Rafael Grossi, to Israel ahead of the meeting of the Board of Governors is in contradiction with the agency's principles of observing impartiality and maintaining its technical and professional status. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, while pointing to the destructive measures of the Zionist regime, which is the main culprit of illegal nuclear activities in the world. Amir Abdullahian censured the, quote, hasty and unconstructive move by the U.S. and the three European countries, namely Britain, France, and Germany, in compiling a draft resolution at the IAEA. He said such behavior goes against diplomacy and will complicate the talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 deal between Iran and the world powers. He reiterated Iran's resolve to reach a good, strong, and lasting deal. Iran's foreign minister also said his country will immediately, effectively, and